Welcome to the Midterm Matters podcast from the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication. This podcast is part of the Center for Political Communication's upcoming national agenda series, Midterm Matters, addressing the importance of voter and civic engagement in the midterm elections, as well as campaign strategy, news coverage, polling, and more. I'm your host, Delaware Public Media News Director Tom Byrne. I'm joined once again by the UD Center for Political Communications Associate Director and National Agenda Series Director, Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, who teaches communication and political science at UD. Lindsay, thanks for being with us again.
Great to be here.
And for a little different point of view this time, we have with us Eric Hastings, a second-year Master's of Public Administration student at UD, also a research assistant and legislative fellow at UD's Institute for Public Administration, and co-creator of the Make It Count campaign, a student-led initiative under the Biden Institute. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right started with the latest, I guess. And one of the things that seems to be coming a little bit clearer as we move into fall and the end of primary season is we're getting kind of a clearer picture of who is actually going to be on the ballot this November across the country. And one of the things we're seeing is a more diverse group, women, Muslims, LGBTQ candidates, all on the rise across the country. And even here in Delaware, for example, the race for U.S. Senate has two openly gay candidates, Republican Gene Truono and Democrat Kerry Harris. So my first question to you guys is, what does this trend say to you, especially just after a couple of years where so much was made of white middle-class men in President Trump's victory?
Yeah, I think, it's clear that post-Trump there was a big movement for a lot of women and minorities. There has been a real grassroots organization for them to become empowered to run. And so many of these women and minorities are running for the first time. What I think kind of interesting about the Delaware race is that Harris and
Truono
sort of joked that if they both win their primaries, then their sexual orientation won't be part of the topic of conversation. And wouldn't that be crazy if we get to that point, you know, where we have two minorities have that sharing the same kind of background. But I think that really what I've seen in following a lot of engagement groups on social media, it was a huge upswing in the number of groups who are engaging with non-traditional candidates and the number of people who are getting on board with those.
How about you, Eric?
Yeah, for me, I think it's every action has a reaction mentality here. I had some conversations among my cohorts not too long ago about the election of Donald Trump and maybe it being a reaction to Barack Obama, almost, polar opposites in every way. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're having something like this, but in different levels here, to where Donald Trump represents maybe something very different than many of these candidates here. So, and for me, I think it just is kind of an empowering movement for them and saying that, it's a full speed ahead moment. The dam is breaking. If it's going to break, maybe it should be now. So it's really interesting, especially in Delaware. I mean, we've recently made history with Lisa Blunt Rochester, mm-hmm. of course. And so it wouldn't be out of the norm for us to continue this trend, but for it to be now a countrywide theme in certain places, quite inspiring to see. It's very interesting. But for me, it simply comes down to, for every action, I think this is a simple reaction.
I think that's a really good point, Eric. And I will point out at this juncture that he owes all of his political knowledge to me. He was a student of mine while he was here at UD. I'm kidding. He's a very smart young man. I think that what you bring up is really interesting, because in 2010, we saw something very similar. Then it was the Tea Party. They were the outsider candidates. And it was very much a reaction to Obama and to Democrats as a whole. So I think this is going to be a very interesting race to watch across the country.
Is there anything else you think we can glean from the primaries and special elections we've seen to date? Do you feel like we know any more about what's motivating voters or what issues are taking hold? I know last podcast we talked about the angst and anxiety, with voters, but do we feel like we've learned anything in the last, month or so about what's taking hold? Or is this going to kind of be like, I kind of liken it to a roulette wheel. We're just going to keep spinning it, and whatever it comes up on, black or red, in November is what that issue is going to be. But it's going to be a constantly mm-hmm. spinning type of thing. I don't know. What do you guys think?
For me, I think, especially for the GOP, the connection to Donald Trump, I mean, there's a lot of research to the early on, if they decided to side with him or not, and, how they're doing now, and whether or not they backtrack to kind of jump in that boat. It seems like the ones who have backtracked are now, going full in. They're just pushing the pot in, if you will. I think for the GOP, it really matters a lot about their connection to to him and to the presidency and what they feel about it, how outspoken they have been about it in itself. But from my personal view as well, the trends is, especially as it's getting, you know, November's getting closer and closer, young people, because of, I think, the dramatic fashion that's unraveling in national politics, it's an easy invite for people to want to get involved. Because unfortunately, politics can be kind of gritty and it can be thick in the weeds. You need to do some research. But because of the large-scale fashion, especially the recent news as of today, you know, and things that have unfolded, I think it invites a new group of people who are not necessarily used to being involved in politics to get involved, because in a weird way, it's kind of like a soap opera now.
Andy, what do you think?
Well, we should timestamp this today, because everything is happening so quickly. So it's we're taping this on Thursday, August 23rd. And yeah, absolutely what's happened with Manafort and Cohen. I think at this point in the campaign, we're in late August. People are starting to pay attention. This could have a lasting impact. But what I was going to bring up was another interesting race between Beto O'Rourke and Ted Cruz. It just poll just came out that that Cruz is leading by just 4 percentage points. And to me, that's wild. I mean, this is Texas. This is a, you know, conservative state. So I think it, the special elections and the polling that we're seeing does seem to demonstrate what we're hearing is being called kind of a blue wave or whatever it might be that could happen this fall.
And Eric, and that polling in that race has been kind of that close for some time now.
Sure.
So this is not an outlier.
Right. And for him especially, I think recently his news is he had a very elegant way of explaining the national protests in the NFL. And for young people, I get on Facebook and Twitter, people I'm connected with in my age group, all of a sudden now there's this wave of retweeting his speech and things of that nature. So again, maybe it's been like that, but because now we're getting closer, people are bringing out the best of themselves, supposedly, or you'd like to think. But because, again, that's a very dramatized issue, it's something that's easy to have an opinion about. You don't have to know too much. The way he explained it, I would think any reasonable person on either side maybe could maybe agree with him in a way. I think you explained that elegantly. I may disagree with you in total or how I feel about it, but the way he went about it wasn't very divisive, and it was kind of inviting to the everyday person. And people who didn't normally agree with the NFL protests, where I'm from more a conservative area in Delaware, I saw them kind of sharing and being like, this was interesting. I kind of liked the way this guy went about it. He seemed like your everyday person. I don't know. Maybe that might be the case other places as well.
Well, and for young people who are voting for the first time, that kind of message can really ring through over a policy message or something that's that's a little bit more wonky. So I think that a lot of these outsider candidates who are running as outsiders and as people who are like, I don't really know a lot more than you do about this, but I'm ambitious and I can get it done. I think that's appealing to a younger set of voters. And, you know, I mention this probably every podcast, but we have this the largest voting bloc in this country right now. And, you know, whatever people say about millennials and Gen Z or whatever the upcoming one is called, about them not voting in midterm elections historically, is absolutely true. I think we might see something different this year, particularly if those candidates reach out to that group of voters.
We're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. But Lindsay, I do want to pick up on one thing you talked about. You mentioned the blue wave, so I got to go to the blue wave. I know you like to eschew the predictions, but we are starting to see more and more discussion and analysis on the possibility of this blue wave that gives Democrats the House, for instance. How much credence, you know, you don't have to make a prediction, but how much credence should we be putting in these kind of statistical breakdowns? And do you think that type of reporting on those breakdowns has an impact on voters if they think a blue wave is coming or may not be coming?
Oh, that's a really complicated question.
That's what I do best.
Because I think back to 2016 and how many voters said they sat it out because the polling suggested that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And so supporters who may have gone out to vote for her decided not to. So this is kind of a chicken and the egg thing. You know, how much does the coverage impact turnout? It's one of those things that's very difficult from a social science perspective to really trace. But I think there is some element of truth in that. That said, 538, which has always been one of my go-tos in terms of predictions, is saying that Democrats have a chance, 72% chance, 72.4% chance of winning the House. And they break that down in a number of different ways by district. And I'll give that a caveat, is because Nate Silver, who started 538, also had to give a pretty big apology post-2016 mm-hmm. because the polling wasn't there. It wasn't necessarily accurate. He gives a lot of reasons for this, which I won't bore you by going into all the polling, the science of polling. But there were voters that they didn't reach, and he also thinks that there were many voters who were maybe not willing to admit who they were going to vote for. So there's a lot of things like that. I think we need to be wary of that this time around, too. But I also think that pollsters are took that blow pretty seriously, mm-hmm. and they're working very hard to obtain a much more generalizable samples.
Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. 538 is also a go-to for me as a sports fan. My March Madness time of the year, I usually are logged in pretty hard to those numbers. But again, it's going to be kind of hard to tell. I mean, the best thing I took out of this was how the House has swung historically. You know, I like to look at the past. And again, this action-reaction mm-hmm. mentality is something, kind of a symbolic thing that I keep in my mind. It just leans just enough Democratic. And obviously, if a president is not performing well, traditionally as well, there's a reaction where the House or the Senate may try to flip as well. You know, there's only so much, again, credence you can put into polling. They do their best. They're experts. But at the end of the day, it's who shows up. You know, Lindsay makes a great point with the Hillary supporters, and even before that with some of the Bernie supporters. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one tier before even Hillary got to that extent. So, yeah, it's tough. I'd like to give it, you know, a good faith effort, but I'll see it. I'll believe it when I see it.
Well, you mentioned who's going to show up, and Eric, as we mentioned at the top, you're co-creator of the Make It Count campaign,
yes.
the student-led initiative under the Biden Institute. Goal is to increase voter registration and nonpartisan civic engagement. So tell us a little bit more about that project and what you're going to be doing as UD students get back on campus.
Sure. So this was a direct answer to Joe Biden's call. There was a Biden is Back event on campus a few Aprils ago, and he asked students to, I believe it was a Burbridge, and I'll keep it PG, was to get off your butt and vote. You know, if you felt strongly enough about something, to go something and do about it. And I feel strongly enough about this. Fortunately, I was fortunate enough to get such a great education here as undergraduate. I owe Lindsay quite a bit of that, as well as Phil Jones, who you've had on here before, mm-hmm. for my political understanding, especially when it comes to media and communication. So for us, we wanted to make this a grassroots campaign. Especially as students, we did not want this campaign to kind of come in a box and it to feel cardboard, cutout-like. So we thought the best way to engage our communities was on the ground and to talk to people and to get to know them and to meet them somewhere in the middle. So the most important thing to say about this campaign is that it is a nonpartisan mm-hmm. approach. This is simply to get people out to the polls or engaged to understand the process, to invite them back into the political world. We kind of the same. We want to make politics sexy again in a way, mm-hmm. or something that you can talk about at home without feeling kind of I need to keep my true feelings to myself. So there's really a two-pronged approach here. First, as we look at the numbers, only 57% of UD students voted in the 2016 presidential election who were eligible to vote. That's, you know, as someone who I believe Delaware being a pretty active state, especially as small as it is, you know, it was kind of disturbing to see that. And even more so, it becomes so much lower at the local levels and, mm-hmm. and at the school board levels. So for us, we want to boost those numbers. And again, it doesn't matter which way you vote, we just want you to go there. So the first approach is voter engagement drives. We've already had several of them last academic year, and we'll have plenty more this year. The main focus of that is to get people to register for TurboVote. That's really your one-stop shop for all the voting needs, whether it's about reminders, your polling places, all of those things. That's where you go. So we use that as our tool, and we have the backup with the Biden Institute, the Center for Political Communication, to kind of guide us in the right way. You know, if we feel as though we need some guidance, and it really helps us as students, because the most important thing is everybody who is involved with this is really a volunteer. This isn't our job. Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier, you know, I'm employed to the university as a research assistant at the IPA. That is not a Biden Institute position.
Right.
This is something I do in my free time. So I think that shows a lot of desire for young people right here. We're the proof that on our own free time, you know, after we've already had several hours of classes or work, a lot of us are graduate students as well. We work part-time, right, full-time students, but it matters enough for us to get out. So voter engagement drives is our first prong. The second prong is more of this, what we call living room conversations, which we're hoping to beef up with, especially with Partnership for the Center for Political Communication, is where we try to get everybody in a room, as crazy as that may be, and to actually put our phones away for a little while and to have a real authentic conversation across from a table from somebody. Look them in the eye and tell them, you know, where I'm from, what do you really think? People from different backgrounds, we try to make it as diverse as possible with the end goal realizing that we probably have more in common than we do in difference. Right now, it's cool to have things in, you know, difference.
Right.
It's cool to say you're on team A, I'm on team B. We're trying to make people realize that maybe we're actually all on the same team. It's just that maybe we had different opinions of how we should get to a certain goal. We've had several of those conversations where students have left feeling more engaged, a little more optimistic about the political process because they learned something about the gun issue growing up as a hunter. You know, where I'm from, that's very prominent to go out and use guns, to have guns in the household. But maybe someone who is, meeting someone who's been the victim of gun violence in their family or a friend, maybe you meet somewhere in the middle about that. That's what we aim to do here. And it doesn't work unless we have the grassroots approach because we approach students where they're at. You know, it's not a cardboard cutout way like Joe Biden, I think, would want it. It's very blue collar, in your face, if you will. And the Make It Count mantra is simply about that. We want to ensure that we're making it count at the ballot box, but maybe more importantly, we're making it count in our hearts and how we feel about these issues.
I
was just going to, off of what Eric was saying, this is also the first year that this Make It Count campaign, which again was student generated, we have submitted that agreement to what's called the All In Challenge. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually competing with over 300 other campuses this year to see how many students we can get to register to vote, to actually go out and vote. So this adds a level of excitement, I think, for, mm-hmm. for students. And I'll say even outside of that competitive nature of this campaign, I haven't seen University of Delaware students this excited about an election, much less a midterm election, in the decade that I've been here. There's a definite energy, I think, on our college campus, and I think on a lot of college campuses, particularly as these new 18-year-olds are coming in as freshmen. I think that I really do think we might see a big change in demographics as we come out of this. And I think it's largely because of students like Eric who are taking the lead and saying, you know what, I'm not going to leave this up to my professors or to, you know, administrators at the university. We're going to do this. We're going to make a difference.
Having said that, I mean, mm-hmm. do you still see some challenges though in engaging students as you're building this process?
Sure, absolutely. The part of our mission is to combat apathy. There's a brilliant MLK quote that I really bring with me all the time, is that, you know, in this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. And I think that in our swirl of life here in the college campus, it's a bubble, right? We're only concerned maybe about our next exam, what am I going to do for dinner tonight, whatever it might be. We might forget that there's things that are operating outside of this few square mile campus, and there's people back home that depend on us or depend on our vote and on our action, especially as people who are educated. We have the tools right here at the university that is at epicenter on the East Coast for this kind of stuff. So for me, it's still that apathetic, well, I don't know if it really affects me, you know, kind of, I think that my district's already really in the bag for so-and-so. So what does it mean for me? It's about setting a standard, now a precedent. If you are going to break that trend in your family, maybe of apathy, or maybe a politically involved family, maybe now your little brother or little sister will, because they see that you did it. Maybe your future children will. You have to build a new tier. It has to be a new plateau of saying, this is now the standard that our family, our friends, our peer group will now be, you know, democratically involved, because we're so fortunate to have that right here. And I think if you don't go out and exercise that right, and you complain, there's a disconnect there for me. The good news is we've had great accomplishments already. Just last semester, and I want to mention the competition Lindsay's talking about, we are second only behind the University of Michigan in campuses that had TurboVote signups. And the University of Michigan had been doing it for quite a while. We had only started rolling this out in April of this year. We had planned for a while. We wanted to do this right. But in that time from April to early June, we had 1,059 TurboVote signups. here on this campus. That's tremendous and propelled us past very large universities to only being right behind the University of Michigan.
That's great. So
for us, that's that completely shattered our goals and our expectations, but I think it's a testament to the energy that we're bringing, this kind of, Lindsay mentioned, maybe the campus is starting to wake up to this now, and now with Joe Biden, you know, really getting all in on this. I've had a few meetings with him, have been fortunate enough to explain the accomplishments, and he's very inquisitive. Well, what do you mean accomplishments? You know, tell me more about that. But it just shows that even he, at this highest level of political accomplishment, he'll take the time to want to learn and understand what we're doing and be part of it as well.
Sounds very cool. We're keeping an eye on that as we move up toward November. I want to move to some of the local issues happening with these midterms, starting with the kind of growing attention on the Democratic primary in the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Senator Tom Carper and Kerry Harris. Lindsay, you'll recall last time we talked about the kind of the uphill climb that Harris faces. She herself told a local blog that her campaign feels it needs about 25,000 votes to win. So I did the math because that's what I do. And that supposes about a 15 to 17% turnout. So I guess I'm just going to ask the blanket question. Have either of you seen anything that makes you think that, that's an achievable thing for Harris to get to that level and win that race?
Well, I'll give you an anecdote. I was at my daughter's school last week getting ready for the school year. And a parent came up to me. She knows I study politics. And she said, "Have you heard about this Kerry Harris?" And she said, "I don't really pay attention to this stuff, but I'm hearing a lot about her," and that was indicative to me of kind of a general. There's a lot of attention being paid to her. She's one of these again non-traditional candidates,
sure. Mm-hmm.
But for me, what I see as being indicative of her being a potentially real challenge is Carper's response. We now have billboards, advertisements. They're going to debate on August 27th at Cab Calloway. So it's you wouldn't be engaging in that kind of politics if you didn't feel a little bit threatened. Even though he's outraised her by, I think it's about 19-1, I think that there's a real potential here for a shift.
Eric, what do you think?
Sure, I also have an anecdote as well. Several weeks ago, it must have been 1 a.m., 1:30 a.m., I had a friend text me and go, "What do you think about Kerry Harris?" It was very late at night. I was like, what are you doing up? What's going on right now? But, you know, those are the people I kind of surround myself with that you go down these rabbit holes, if you will, of things that matter. So we had quite a lengthy conversation, later at night about that of saying, well, you know, really interesting, checks off all the diverse boxes you can really, really ask for in a race like this against, you know, pretty much a polar opposite. The general, we have a longstanding,
right.
Older white male who's, been in Delaware politics for 40 years, or right. If not more now. For me, getting those kind of questions, again, that's just one of many examples, is, again, of this kind of twinkling, like, it's becoming dusk and the lights are starting to come on kind of thing. That's kind of the metaphor I'm using now. Some people are starting to twinkle on of saying, mm-hmm. Wait a second, and fortunately, I don't want to say it's definitely not too late, but this is someone that maybe deserved a little more attention even earlier on because of the background that she has. Sure, not a ton of political experience, but sounds like a heck of a lot of life experience mm-hmm. That can bring to politics.
Well, if I can go back to 2010, we're talking about parallels and this kind of pendulum swinging mm-hmm. back and forth. Let's remember that 2010, the Tea Party favorite, Christine O'Donnell, beat Mike Castle, which was completely unexpected. So in the Senate Republican primary. So I think we are in a year that's a lot like 2010. But now we're kind of focusing on the Democrats and who's going to succeed in these primaries.
Yeah, I would
special elections.
And I would suggest, I think that's part of the, you mentioned Carper kind of engaging more. And I think mm-hmm. that a lot of that is his having seen what happened to Castle, that maybe if that
right.
hadn't happened, maybe he would still just be kind of like, oh, I'm just going to like ignore
that's
her.
That's true. Yeah.
I think
kind of ignored the.
But until it was too late. And that was mm-hmm. the key there. Like, you could tell, I mean, I covered that campaign. You could tell at the end, like his people, they were clearly getting numbers that were telling them, something's wrong. And there wasn't enough time to figure it out. Carper's people, again, if you kind of presume this may be his last run anyway, like, why is he going to keep the powder dry? Why wouldn't you spend the money?
Yeah.
You're probably not going to need it in November. You might as well spend it now, right, and put up the billboards and do all the ads and things like that now, right?
Sure. I mean, I just, as of this morning, drove from Laurel, Delaware up here, so it's about a two-hour drive, and it was even in lower parts of Maryland as of yesterday. So I saw more cutouts for Carper in that drive up Route 1 and 13 today than I've ever seen in my entire life, which, and he's been part of politics before I was born. But it's funny that we mentioned that because he has the biggest signs and yep. he has some of the most signs and integral parts of my drive, which is a, you're going from a, you know, south gets to, you know, up here in Newark. And it was interesting to see that. And maybe I didn't really think about it till now that we mentioned it, but if I play back that drive, it was an awful lot of signs. I don't remember so much when I was younger.
Yeah.
I think there's sort of a backfire effect too, to the increase in signs and the ads. Cause I think that's why people are like, well, wait, who is this woman?
Gives her legitimacy.
That's true. There's no doubt about that. And I do think you took me right to a point I wanted to make, which is these are kind of two very different campaigns. I mean, you know, Carper is definitely the traditional signs, billboards, ads, where Harris, I mean, I know, you know, I've had a couple of friends of mine who've told me, you know, they've gotten texts from her campaign, you know, even just kind of like general inquiry ones like, hey, have you heard of Carrie Harris, you know, telling about her? It's like, would you like to hear more about her? And that's, it seems like they are definitely kind of running, you know, different campaigns, one more old school, one more new school. And this could be very informative to see, you know, have we started to reach a tipping point on the way that you connect with voters? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's still always the Delaware way, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Have we reached that point yet, or maybe we're not there yet?
I don't know. That's a good question. What do you think?
Well, I am a lifelong Delawarean, but I can only say that, you know, I have understanding, I would say, in my adult life. I'm 26 now, so I can't speak to the younger years. But, same thing. I also got a text message, one of the automated ones.
Yep.
It's not just from her. I've got it from other candidates as well.
Yep.
I think people are understanding this is a way to reach that unique pocket. There's this understanding now that maybe your safe voters aren't so safe, and that's the first people you go after now. But what about the people who are also the complete middle? And so for me, you know, this is a really interesting race. I'm not even quite sure what I'd like to do here. But the fact that someone has these unique opportunities to reach out to you, and they're seeking out different ways in the demographics, they know where they're hitting. It's really interesting to me. I think there is always going to be a Delaware way. I mean, you've seen the track people have taken over time. You know, Governor Carney is a good example of that. You know, it's kind of, some people call it a cycle or this one-way track. Because of the size of our state, and there's only so many powerful positions that may stay that way for a while. I hope to break that one day as well and get into all of that. But that's a story for another time. But yeah, the texts are interesting to me, and it definitely wakes me up to it. It makes me do the research at the 1:30 a.m. because I'm getting text messages.
Exactly. And I do want to put some context, and we talked about this before we started recording. You know, Carper did face a primary in 2012. It was against an unknown, Keith Sparinelli. There was about 17% turnout, which is what the Harris campaign seems to be looking at is their goal. Or their thought, at least, of what's going to happen. And, you know, Carper wound up getting about 43,000 votes in that race. So you're looking at, you know, Harris somehow trying to peel away 20,000 people who just last time Carper ran were willing to vote for him in a primary with 17% turnout. It's a pretty daunting road, but it does feel like there's more energy than there had been maybe previously.
Absolutely. And I think that the endorsement by Ocasio-Cortez, you know, is a really strong point in Harris's favor. It's a moment. These are the kinds of things I love about politics, when you witness a moment. And I feel like we are witnessing something that I was, you know, I'm always like, oh, this is going to be in a book one day. You know, that there was this major thing that happened, and it was for this example, it's that these kind of non-traditional people are standing up and saying, you know what, I can do this. Enough. I'm tired of relying on the same old people who've been in politics for decades. And I think that that she's kind of capitalized on that.
I want to hit a couple other things real quick. The AG's race locally got a GOP candidate, Peggy Marshall-Thomas, who then dropped out. It's replaced by a Democrat on the GOP side, Bernard Pepikai, who changed party affiliations to run as a Republican in this race. Is that a bad sign for the Delaware GOP that they had a turn to a lifelong Democrat who's held some pretty prominent positions in the Democratic Party to run as their standard bearer in this race?
I'd say that's a red flag. Or maybe I should say a blue flag. I think that that's, I think that it's indicative that you know, it's just, you know, I'm not a lifelong Delawarean, so I don't have a good understanding of kind of the history of growing up here and being here. But you know, it's a blue state, so it's got to be difficult as a GOP, as a Republican, to kind of keep bringing that enthusiasm to every contest when you have to kind of come to the understanding that most of the time, Democrats are going to win.
Mm-hmm. And it does seem, Eric, that, I mean, the GOP has been able to field legislative candidates. So there is a enthusiasm there. It seems that the problem they may be stuck on is these statewide races, is finding someone who's willing to invest what you need to do to run statewide as opposed to maybe just running in your district.
Yeah, I agree with that to an extent as well. And this is an interesting story as well. I mean, from not just the switching perspective, but such an interesting Delaware story whereby, Bernard here for the AG now is the Republican candidate had a charge early on that Tom Carper eventually pardoned, allowed him to go on to even have this opportunity in life and go into law school and have a very storied career. Really interesting Delaware story, like kind of more specific to that. But that you have two kind of hardened, battle-tested candidates now on both sides. It certainly makes it more interesting. But it is I wouldn't say odd, but at least worth a little asterisk that the GOP felt as though we need anybody, and it wasn't just anybody. They pegged somebody with quite a list of accomplishments as well. Something to keep an eye on for sure, at the very least.
And finally, in that race, I do want to talk about the fundraising there. Kathy Jennings raising $441,000 over the past 7 months, more than twice the three primary opponents she has combined. That's interesting, your thoughts on like how much of an advantage does that create, or is it at all maybe neutered a little bit because it's a primary, that there's only so much advantage you can get by having that much money to work with in a primary with relatively low turnout?
Yeah, I mean, money is power in politics. So, I think it's such a muddied race, and I think that in some ways, earlier this year, I think a lot of Delawareans were talking about this race, but now that Harris has become more visible, I think this race is getting a little bit more in the background. I don't think people are paying quite as much attention to it. So, all that money might not do you so good. Do very well, particularly when there's just so many people and there happens to be another Kathy, so kudos for raising the money, but who knows if it's really going to make a difference in the long run.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think, again, back to the not soap opera so much here, because I think Carper and Harris are above maybe that term, for sure. But it again invites a new crowd of people to be interested in especially our state politics. Again, it's fresh all of a sudden again at a very important position that has been longstanding and not so much contested over time. Maybe it is being overshadowed a little bit. The Attorney General's office is also kind of a harder to understand office for your general non-political person. So maybe again, the money is always going to help. There's no way around that. And it's unfortunate and very unfortunate that money has such a big part in politics. However, I think Lindsay makes the best point is right now, I think a lot of eyes are on this Carper Harris thing.
All right. Well, we're going to finish up as we always do with a quick hot take or a hot quick take, whichever way you want to take it. Lindsay, we're going to start with you.
All right.
And you can show Eric how it's done.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Hang on a second here. Let me get my...
We've got props?
Oh, this is my... Wow. Don't you love that sound of a newspaper?
I know, seriously. I haven't seen one of those. I was
going
to say.
This, I just pulled this out.
Going
this
old school.
This is the Sunday New York Times from August 19th. And my quick hot take this week is about how journalism and journalists are really talk about having a moment. They're having a moment. And this particular story that I'm looking at right now is about fact-checking Trump's claims about Russia. It's like a point-by-point fact-check and they're using the they're using terms, and the Washington Post as well, they're using terms like lie and the misleading. They're going that far. There's a confidence among journalists that I think is evident in the Boston Globe having more than 300 news publications across the country joining together to write those editorials about the power and importance of the free press. So I think it's, in addition to this, I get so excited about the news, I'm sorry, but podcasts like The Daily are just, and like this one, of course, are just such a great way to get a deep dive into these issues. So I have to give a lot of credit to The Wall Street Journal is another one that's been covering this Cohen Manafort thing with a lot of insight. Is I think with this renewed confidence that journalists are having over after having been called fake news and all these things, it's creating maybe a different type of journalism. I'm seeing more explainers, more background deep dives, particularly again with this Cohen Manafort thing, like, okay, well, how did this thing work out with Nixon? What exactly happened then? And the Daily, like I said, the Daily, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post are all, along with many others, are really taking the opportunity to not just focus on the breaking news of this, let's just face it, a reality show presidency. I think that journalists are and should step away from those kinds of quick breaking news stories and provide context. That's the thing that people really need when they're getting ready to vote. They need to know what the background is. So hooray for journalists is my take.
Eric, you're up.
I love that one. Lindsay and Phil Jones, both the people you've had on this, were reasons why I actually wanted to go into journalism, and I may still one day. I had a short sports career in that end, but I think early on there was this kind of just slap on the wrist mentality, but this standing up for each other kind of thing, and the more hard language is, I think it's important to see, because now they're the gatekeepers for good, because this is definitely one way or another is going to be in the history books, however this turns out. My kids one day will be reading this in their civics classes. And so, the journalists are going to be the people who help mold that. For me, the hot take, and this is a hot take, it's direct in relation to some of the research that's been showing that the youth vote, my age group supposedly, or, people in their 20s, it's not going to happen. We're not going to come out. And people attribute that to a blue wave, maybe not being so much a wave, but maybe just like a little
undertow.
Tide pool. Yeah, just a little splash. My hot take is that it is going to happen. Again, separate from my nonpartisan approach here, I just want to get people in the door. What they do after that's up to them. But for me, and kind of my personal understanding and my interest in politics, I think that blue wave is actually coming because of how national politics have invited the everyday person into the living room conversation, if you will. I just had a great conversation with my parents before I left for this, about the national view. They're more engaged than they ever have been. As well. But for us, the youth vote, I know that for many of the registration numbers, especially after the Parkland, Florida, tragedy, people thought that was going to be the big boost. Unfortunately, some of the numbers aren't showing that. I don't think it's too late for this to happen. Again, I think it's starting to twinkle on now. It's becoming dusk, and people are going to start waking up to it. So if it's going to be red or blue or whatever it is, my hot take is that the blue wave will come and at least the House will switch.
All right. Dr. Lindsay Hoffman, Associate Director of the UD Center for Political Communication and National Agenda Series Director, and Eric Hastings, Masters of Public Administration student at UD and co-creator of the student-led Make It Count campaign under the Biden Institute. Thank you both for being on the Midterm Matters podcast.
Thank you.
And thanks, everybody, for listening to the Midterm Matters podcast this time.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Midterm Matters podcast, produced by the University of Delaware Center for Political Communication and Delaware Public Media. For more on the UD Center for Political Communication's Midterm Matters National Agenda Series this fall, visit cpc.udel.edu.